Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Elizabeth Savage. Elizabeth Savage is the author of Jane and Paige, or Sister Goose. She is also the author of Grammar, a new collection of poems which was just released from Furniture Press. She is the poetry editor for the journal Kestrel, a journal of culture and art. And she is also a professor of English at Fairmont State University in Fairmont, West Virginia. Hi, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's really good to have you here.
Feels like a homecoming.
Yeah.
Was in Pittsburgh for graduate school in the 90s, and it's always nice to come back. So thank you.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you. So you're going to read some poems from Grammar, and so please go ahead.
Okay. A common noun enfolds both leaves and flowers, comprehensive partitions of fertile rendition. Fly, heat, sort, drive, friend, console, claim, bribe. Building blocks of life come to the cellular screen and loop the frame like teeth to law, as feet to claw, that tract of green we tread upon, a sound by which a thing is called. And the next poem is an abstract noun. News is not all. It is difficult to drink long from its flimsy cup or for its inky ships to meet the drowning. Yet many a man is making friends with misery for lack of news alone. Every day, even as I speak, for I too am concerned, hear me out. It is more difficult to get love from poems that rise and sink and rise again, gathering into gardens of gentleness and goodness, hot with memory, but offering at last no table cheer, no food for lung or bone. It well may be, but it is not the end of the world. The next poem is about my favorite part of speech, prepositions. So much depends upon the burdens with which we wheel beside our happiness. So much happiness depends upon a rural imaginary glazed with whitewashing beside darker dressings. So much hangs upon short words with long arms, tea, bill, all, free. Beside ourselves, once upon a time, with our laurels at rest besides, so much for history balancing its red load. The next poem is my one sexy poem that I've written. The title is You Understood. Provocative partner, where there is urgency, there will be utterance, laying its long cloak over a puddling image, so I may step imperatively into you. I'll read a poem about the most abused form of punctuation, the semicolon. Semicolon smile. Prodigal arena, here is your door, hinged by association. Lady pets tiger, she will not be made to choose. Parenthesis. Spare organ in a useful body, inked for extraction, but the surgeon never arrives. O heart of tinted glass, do you want me to pretend I don't see you? Do you want me to wave back?
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Elizabeth Savage, and she's reading from her new book, Grammar. Okay, well, lots to talk about here.
Okay.
Can you talk about the framework of your book? I mean, obviously, it has to do with grammar, but how did this come about, and how did you decide to actually, you know, create a book focusing on grammar?
Well, I love grammar books, and I inspect them and collect the good ones that are thorough or explain things well, in part because I teach grammar and I want to get better at it, and being familiar with the varying terms for parts of speech and constructions are important. But I happened to find a 1946 primer entitled Drill for Skill, at my in-law's house. My mother-in-law is a retired English teacher. She taught middle school and high school and night school, too, out in California. So this charming book with the sort of military title, Drill for Skill, was in the room where we stayed a couple summers ago. And I was so charmed by some of the exercises and the titles of the lessons, as well as the tone of the foreword. I can't think of the author's name right now, but he takes great pains to explain the function of the book. But it was sort of lying around, and I had finished up Jane and Paige, and I'd been working on that series for many years. Not just that series, though. It was my go-to project, and I was finished with it and was lonely for a focusing project, something to think about while I got other things written. And so I began with the poem Gerund's, actually, just thinking about meditations on language. And I'd intended to use it as a way of thinking about family, but it branched into lots of other meanings of family, you know, language as a family and as a member of language families. So that's how it got started. And then it just became it's almost daily exercise. And then the editor of Furniture Press asked to see what I was working on and was really taken with the project and said he wanted to make it a book. So writing the poems as a book with a certain number in mind was a new exercise for me, and one I enjoyed very much. The book came together in about 14 months. I was done. I didn't get much other kinds of poetry writing done, though. Lots of criticism, but not many other poems.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you say the book came together in 14 months, yet you did a lot of work before that time that enabled you to write those poems, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I don't want to give the idea that anyone can write a book in 14 months.
Oh, no, no, it was...
years of study, years of work.
Oh, study, work, and reading poetry and thinking about poetry. Yeah. But that sense of needing to complete it and to stay concentrated on these ideas was a really fruitful experience. Mm-hmm. But indeed, writing a book is just the end of a long, long time of thinking and writing other things too. And reading is so important too. Right. My reading shows nakedly mm-hmm. in these poems.
Mm-hmm. You know, there may be some listeners who maybe are not in love with parts of speech, you know, and if you say, well, so I started with gerunds, but I think it's eminently clear that this is about parts of speech, but not about parts of speech.
Yeah.
Where you talk about my one sexy poem, which I didn't really believe you, because I think a lot of these are sexy. I mean, there's so many evocative moments of sound and movement in these poems. So, I mean, can you talk about these other levels in the book that, I mean, I was feeling, just in the poems that you've read so far, a rising up of sadness and praise from the poems.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, they are emotional. Gerund's is the first poem that I wrote. Just thinking about, and this will probably sound silly to some people, but the sadness of a verb becoming a noun and the stasis of, to go from action to stasis just seemed sad to me. So you think that's goofy?
No, I don't think it's goofy, but I think it's great. But I'm just thinking of all the English teachers and poets I know who would say yes, yes.
They're my people.
And it's that depth of stopping movement and action and how much that means.
And thinking about those transformations. It often felt like a religious practice or a devotional practice to think about the movements of meaning and their transformations and reversions. Something I did in these poems that I don't think I had done much before was to be playful, mm-hmm. and allowing some of them to pull me in the direction of associations that aren't so patrician as grammar and language. And that was nice too, because emotions aren't all serious. They're pleasurable and fun and hard to name and devastating. Prepositions ended up being prepositions are my favorite part of speech because of their anonymity. They're so common and so plentiful that they're often overlooked, but they're so important to any sentence. They determine the relationships among the words, but it became a poem about my sadness about our nation in the past couple of years, the divisiveness and inability to speak to one another, mm-hmm. reluctance to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm. So the language itself becomes a metaphor in your book.
It does at times.
Mm-hmm. Could you read some more?
I'd love to. Thank you. And I'll start with one of those playful ones. I've found that even devoted English teachers are unfamiliar with the term expletives. We think it means cuss words. And it does mean cuss words. But it's also the construction that's common in the American idiom that begins it is or there is. So this is the expletives. There's a right way and a wrong way to have courage, although it is difficult even when it's been real. Sometimes it's hard to be a woman. There's more than one way to skin, sweet talk, red wine, a well-placed wind. It's a cinch, so it's a deal. It is a matter of opinion whether it is feast or famine, raining or pouring cats in a dog-eat-dog world. It's a shame the way you mess around. It's a boy or it's a girl. There's a thin line between loving thy neighbor and standards of learning. It's just common sense. There's a method to our madness, and it's high time we took the better part. It's as plain as the nose cut off in spite of your face. Hey, baby, it's the 4th of July. There's time to take the 5th. Read present tense. And I wrote this poem after I went to the Stein Collects exhibit of Gertrude Stein and her family's artworks. And so I had a lot of still lifes in my mind when I came home and became a way of thinking about the present tense. Is the wish for peace merely affection for the still life, the radio's calm weather report, or white envelopes ordered in a box? Such clearings of simplicity arrest the commonplace as conclusion, and so observable. The huddled apple and fearless pears quiet us over their good cloth draping a resolute surface, an assurance of flesh, motion having put aside function in favor of the dove, not flame, curled in the belly. Independent elements. No connection, no obligation to ear or mind. The truth comes and goes as it pleases without disrupting itself. A comet, disposable as a ghost, exiting through its own door. I'll read capitalization next. Proper nouns have no wilderness in them. They are profitable instead. Content in their erect originality, pride of the sentence with punctuality of head. Uppercase in the memory, they hold the upper hand to rise above benevolence that stoops below a line. Tall and lusty habits, a foot in serif preened, frozen to perfect sharpness without humility. Principle and property may dazzle open ground or top themselves in flourishes until they're toppling down. They cannot love the common and will not know the dust. In eagerness to shout, they start without taking in a sound.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Elizabeth Savage. She's reading her poetry from her new collection, Grammar. You know, as you read on, I keep thinking about, you know, the evocative nature of what you're reading. And I like, you know, in poetry, it seems that there's always jumping off points, but it seems like there's so many in your poems. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, in terms of the compression you use, the sound, and it's hard to know the line breaks, but I feel like I can feel a lot of edges and endings in your poetry.
Oh, I'm glad for that, and it speaks to a concern that I had when I first started to do readings, because I do write with compression as my foremost priority, to get as much meaning out of the visual line as it plays against the sentence or completed utterance. And that can make it really hard to read sometimes, because you have to choose where you inflect and when to pause and when you don't, so that people can understand what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt myself bound to the page in ways that I hadn't realized. But I love to do readings. I love to say the words and not just to read the words. So it's since I've started to do readings more regularly, I think it's affected the ways that I write with that aural sense. Although sound has always been important to me, but sound is different from saying.
So you're saying, since you've been doing readings more, that you have more attention to sound in your work? Or
yes, more attentive, I think, to the separations between words and the deliberate and the involuntary ways that syntax asks to be inflected, I think, if that makes sense.
Although I would imagine, even before you've done a lot of readings, that you were reading these out loud.
I did, but I avoided it. I often felt really silly reading my poems out loud. But in workshops, and I've been very lucky in that I have found people wherever I have lived. Mm-hmm. Donna Long, who's my colleague, and I carried on a workshop, just the two of us, for many years. And mm-hmm. we always begin by reading first the other person's poem, and then you have to read it yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's a good exercise, just like other kinds of writing, to read it out loud. But
well, I think you do a really good job of reading the work, because it, as you say, it's compressed, and some of the poems are shorter, so it's so important the way you read it. I know that you're a poetry editor for Kestrel. Its full name is A Journal of Literature and Art, and it's in Fairmont, West Virginia, comes out of there. Can you talk about that journal and if that has any effect on your writing, your editorial work?
That's such a good question. One of the missions that we have with Kestrel is to be genuinely eclectic, and I think that we know a good poem in whatever form it comes: narrative, non-narrative, traditional, non-traditional, sound-driven, rhyme-driven, image-driven. And there's the affection I have for writing and for reading is the best part of writing and reading, and the sense of connection with other people. So I think that feeling a part of something larger, of an enthusiasm that I didn't feel before I started editing and reading other people's work so regularly and reading so much of it, that has certainly affected my writing. I'm feeling a part of something rather than isolated. But I don't often read work that seems like something that I could write. I often am rejoicing that other people can write in these ways that I know I can't.
Yeah.
That they can write so frankly about intimate relationships and emotions, that they are so skilled at telling stories and mm-hmm. with brevity and grace.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's a lot of enrichment and community in what you do, and the other part of that is, you know, people can't do what you're doing either, so it's kind of balances out.
Oh, well, that's nice to say. I often feel like I'm kind of cheating with my short poems.
I think short poems are harder to write.
Well, I'm actually working on a project now to returning to just bare bone poems, as thin and light as I can get them. Grammar has quite a few that to my surprise, actually went over to a second page when it turned into a book. And I was surprised by that, and am still getting used to turning a page when I'm reading.
Okay. Could you read some more?
Yes. I think I'd like to read a couple from Grammar, and then if there's time, read maybe one or two from Jane and Paige or Sister Goose.
Okay.
I'll read the last two poems in Grammar. The primer that I spoke of ends with a series of exercises to show your mastery. So I put all of the tests into one poem. Mastery test 1 through 7. The ecstasy to guess is sometimes inconvenient, the whir of solution bliss. If Grace could talk, she'd say douse the candle, burning at both ends, read by the light you have. Glossary. Pencil, finger, another book, keeps your place, and after, the binding cracks. The chapbook, Jane and Paige or Sister Goose, 24 Women and Girls, begins with this poem, the title poem, Jane and Paige or Sister Goose. Schoolwork isn't hard for Jane while Paige is held indoors, stuck on her fours. Hands and feet count 20, but 20 more remain from pinky back to thumb again, then fail to divide, denying her the sun outside. Morning recess pauses are plenty for Paige to see herself as Jane, who thinks of threes as baby toys and coolly eyes the nines. Paige soon learns to memorize, releases her joy and races past the pangs of girlhood, the rain of math. This next poem that's also from the Jane and Paige series is entitled Concealed Weapons, and in part inspired by my iPod that throws up a poem now and again up against a song that the poet would be horrified to be next to. But this day, Robert Frost Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening showed up, and I thought, why does he get to have that poem? The one everyone knows. And so this is Concealed Weapons, and this is for Bobby Frost. Of two generations, neither could know how pure American meanness follows through. Both law and impulse harnesses home to hear, watchful as winter, familiar as snow. Poor girls who won't mother at first feel queer, mastering guns they're given, answering with men so near. Stopped by fathers, voices drop lower than a lake. Errors ring, then leave them frozen to the year. Paige enlisted to give the heavy world a shake. Sun bleached her mind, distinct from her mistakes. Jane packed coastal heat, bridal veils, the churches they sweep. Promised ease with wisdom, silent miles among gentle flake. No one asks and no one tells why they lie so deep. In the motion of storms winds a peace they may not keep. And Jane replies in prayer when darkness stops her sleep. And Paige strikes down words that would put the past to sleep.
Well, the book you're reading from now is entitled Jane and Paige or Sister Goose, 24 Women and Girls, and also published by Furniture Press. It's such a great chapbook. And, you know, we were talking a little before about how committed Furniture Press is to the book. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Christoph Casamassima is the editor of Furniture Press, and Jody Hoover is the artist for the press. And together, they take poetry that seems to grow into the beautiful objects that they make, and each one is different from the others, and each one has some element of handwork in it too, something that's been placed there literally by hand. In Jane and Paige or Sister Goose, the dedications is folded inside under the seam that has to be put there by hand, just as the dedications page has to be cut by hand. And the work that they do there is just phenomenal because of the time it takes and the consideration it takes. Mm-hmm. You feel that your words have really been lived with, not mm-hmm. just read and put between covers.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the listeners can't see this, but they're beautiful books, and you might want to get your hands on Grammar by Elizabeth Savage.
Yeah, the...
Also, it seems to be a theme here about reverence of language, reverence of the made object also. I think we have time for a couple more poems.
Okay, thank you. And I would like to say the cover of Grammar is a painting by the painter Edith Montgomery Arbaugh, who's been painting for many years in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I'm very grateful to her that she let me have this painting. Okay, I'll read a couple from the coda section of Jane and Paige or Sister Goose. And this one is about the first house that I bought as a grown-up. Susie lived in my house as a girl and knows about the trees. The rose of Norway spruce, Mr. Wise's natural fence. For 40 years, he planned his Christmas trees in a tangled band. The blessed shade of atheist pines sows a neighborly forgetfulness of property lines, and I inherit their soft boughs smoothing the ruptured earth, a rooty nuisance, this stretch of mirth. And I'll read one. I wrote for a friend of mine when both of us had our lives sort of fall apart and we went back home to Virginia and became reacquainted then. Natural Bridge. I know a clean man who was a cleaner boy I met on bus stops and in school hallways. His prim authority ordered the very air into purposeful rays across assertive geometrical planes uncluttered by collisions or indecision. Chaos came anyway, and he back to my backyard, frayed but dignified as the irises he carries from his. And lately, he has lifted with them over the old neighborhood fence the messy girl who knew him when. And I'll read Blue Bison. I haven't read this in a long time. Rubbed out of stone in two dimensions, a third, hidden within the flat features and closed eyes, tucked still here, under the rib stands the blue bison's true heart, a girl's face swallowed in love of all she had seen and would. Her unlikely joy at this first sight sent her scrambling for paper and a surface of warm uncertainty. At 12, she has found the rareness is herself, that firsts are not occasion of loss, and blue a delicious color for sleep, beasts, or days to be born over.
The poetry of Elizabeth Savage. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jan. This has been wonderful.
It was great. And I want to mention again that Elizabeth Savage was reading from her chapbook, Jane and Paige, or Sister Goose, 24 Women and Girls, and also her full-length book entitled Grammar. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody, 90.5 FM.